I got my first sponsor, my first legit sponsor, and it's underwear. And it's Sheath. Sheath underwear. Now, I didn't take them out before. Now, these are really interesting underwear. First of all, they smell really good. I mean, they don't smell good. That was gay. They do smell good, actually. They're soft. That's why I put on my face. They're soft underwear. They're naturally cool. Okay? They're called Sheath underwear. They've got this cool logo on them. And then their whole gimmick is that you put your donger, you put your stuff there. And then this is a to-do. I mean, then you put your tube in there. I don't know if you can see that. So your donger rests, your bits are in there and your kibble is in there. And then it's literally like, it gives you a nice little extra package there if you like that. If you're a person that wears jeans. And they got these cool colors. They're funky. And I'm going to tell you something. Go to sheathunderwear.com. Use my promo code. I don't sleep in underwear, man. I usually sleep buck. Because I have sheets like this. Even these are pretty soft. Like, I have bamboo sheets. These are pretty, almost like them. That's pretty right on there. I would sleep on this if it was a sheet. And it's cool. Like, naturally cool. I like to sleep exactly that. I don't like to wear underwear. I wore these to bed last night. And I didn't feel like they were cutting off my circulation. I fell asleep. Like, this isn't me being a hoe. This is me believing. I believe in these underwear. Like, we just started our partnership, you know. In order for them to be my sponsor, I gotta get views, you know. And I think that there's a lot of things that we have to do. But it's like, the algorithm is tough. But I love them. The brand, I haven't met the owner yet, but he's an upstart. It looks awesome. It's actually a very good product. You get a discount. You should try them. If you like underwear, if you like your package packaged up, I would try them, man. They're fucking good. They're really good. Like, I'm not going to do anything that I don't try. You know what I'm saying? So, try them. Do it. Sheathunderwear.com. And promo code Jamie. See, I yawned in the middle of that. You couldn't do that on TV because it doesn't matter. Everyone knows everyone's a liar, and I'm not lying. Larry's back. Back again. Larry's back.
Can you hear me?
I've had actresses on this pod, influencers, strippers, porn stars, and athletes. You are the most, I have to say, care about what you look like before the camera starts than anyone.
No.
Yes, you are.
That's what you're going to say.
I just opened the show with that.
Yeah.
Honesty is the day, dude. You are, what do you care? People, you look great. This isn't going out to fucking 10,000 million people. Look at you. You're mirroring me. You have so much to say, but then when you get on camera, you're scared. So I'm going to teach you. The new world is all about openness and letting it all hang out. Okay. Now, I understand you can keep your image crafted and such, but come on. It's okay. Relax. I want to have you on because you're such a smart guy. Okay? And people really loved your last appearance.
Cool.
Don't be a fucking scaredy cat. You want to control everything.
No.
Yes, you do.
Well,
listen, talk to me first. This is Larry Guterman. Everyone knows him. Director of Ants, Cats and Dogs, Headless, and most importantly, Son of the Mask. Welcome back, buddy.
Thank you.
What's going on with the new cut?
You know, it was, it's only VHS quality res. They've been looking at different ways to up-res it.
Okay.
And also found some other material that improves it even more.
Can I tell people that you found a lot of amazing jewels?
Well, you just did.
I know. You found so many things within the movie that we did, I cry. It's so good.
Yeah, there was a lot of stuff you guys played around with that that worked.
And?
You know, and if wasn't used, and we were able to put some of it in, and it's great. And it's funny. I mean, it's most of the second act worked great in that cut that we talked about last time. And it was really just some of the setup that had a good pacing but just needed a little bit of extra charm and life to it and energy to it. And that's where I found material that you guys improvised that was hilarious.
I know. Trailer's so good.
Yeah, she's great.
Really good. Do you remember when she came in audition?
Yeah.
Do you remember what she did?
No, what did she do?
She was mean to us.
What does that mean?
She came in, did the audition. She's like, okay. And we're like, good job. She's like, mm-hmm. And she was like so aloof.
I have no recollection of that.
And I was like, this girl is so good because she made us want more.
Right.
It was the perfect way to take a meeting. Like, she came in, killed it, and then was like, mm-hmm, and then left.
Uh-huh. She's hilarious.
Hilarious.
And, I mean, she reminded me of, what's her name, from Flirting with Disaster. What's her name? Duchovny's wife.
Yeah. I know what you're talking about, but my brain's done. Yeah.
She's Madame.
Tia Leone.
Tia Leone. She reminded me of Tia Leone, who was, to me, one of the funniest.
She is hilarious.
She is.
She is hilarious.
Yeah.
See what
She was in that show with Ryan Reynolds, right?
Yeah.
Trailer. What was that show?
Two guys, a girl, and a pizza place.
Okay. Yeah.
Now listen, what do you say when you came here the other night?
What did I say?
You said, Jamie, I need to help you. You look at all my posters. What did you say?
Yeah. Just that you were, I saw all the, I mean, I forgot all the stuff that you'd been in. And you had been building incredible momentum at the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, really, it's kind of a rising star momentum out of the blue. Like, you came here with, wait, no connections, right? Nothing.
Nothing.
Just cold.
Cold.
And you built up a career and you built up shows. You created your own show.
Mm-hmm.
Who creates their own show with your name in it?
Mm-hmm.
That was funny and
mm-hmm.
engaging and people loved, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Did movies, did a bunch of, did Scream, did, what's the movie, the Tony Scott, Enemy of the State?
Mm-hmm.
Did, I mean, all these movies that you were in that were A-level, huge, successful movies at the time. So it'd be great to be able to give you the kind of redemption that you deserve. Is that what I said? Something along those lines.
It was beautiful.
Yeah.
I've been thinking about that.
Okay.
Because you need the same redemption. You have so much talent and so much technique. You're a true cinephile. And it's like the town, because of this movie, has completely just, you know, forget what they liked us for in the beginning.
Yeah.
And it's like you have so much skill as a director. Like you're so meticulous. You're so talented. And you look at every little shot and what's the music and the color palette and where is the editing and the pacing. Just talking to you about one idea, it'll take you a while to decide if that's the right idea. Because you think about the whole movie, how it affects the whole movie. And that's an auteur.
Oh, well, thank you. I mean, I think that's what most directors aim to do when they're making a film.
Mm-hmm. Well, not most. There's not a lot of good directors.
Yeah.
There's only a handful. Do you agree with that?
Yeah.
I mean, like, there are a lot of directors. There's just a lot of directors that love the idea of saying they're a director.
Right.
And they get caught up. I hate when directors can't communicate what they want.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, let's just say, I wouldn't say there aren't a lot of good directors. I'd say there aren't a lot of great or brilliant directors, but I do think it's a great art form. It's the best art form. I think it combines music, storytelling, visuals, you know, photography, composition, everything. I mean, sound, design. I mean, there is no other art form that could. I mean, I suppose gaming kind of does it, but gaming is a puzzle. It's not intended to be to generate the kind of emotional catharsis you can get with a film. Right?
And you were talking to me the other night passionately
about what?
About Barry.
Oh, Barry, yeah, Barry's great.
And you had nothing but beautiful, beautiful words to say about Bill Hader.
Yeah, this guy, first of all, when I first recognized Bill Hader, it was, you know, he'd already been on Saturday Night Live but then he was in like Night at the Museum.
Mm-hmm.
Where he played a character in the movie.
Yeah.
And Saturday Night Live is satire. So when you inhabit the role in a Saturday Night Live sketch, it's purposeful exaggeration in order to make a comedic point about what it is that we can laugh at about that kind of character, right? Whether it's the new guy doing Trump who does such a great impression and he exaggerates his run-on sentences and his stream of consciousness way of talking, or whoever it is, it's a deliberate exaggeration. When you're in a movie, you're inhabiting a character where the audience is meant to feel. So that's a whole other level of acting. And not everybody can do that who can do comedy. Bill Hader can. He can be a dramatic actor. He can be a comedic actor. So he was great. And I remember seeing, like, who's this guy in Night at the Museum? Oh, he's really good. Like, he's inhabiting that role. And he had a small role. And he was great. And then years later, SNL, obviously hilarious. And I guess a bunch of stuff was done with John Mulaney. And he does Stefan. He does all these characters. And he can get away with breaking on camera because he's so funny. Because when he laughs at what he's doing, you're also laughing. So you're in on the mm-hmm. jokes. You get a whole other level of enjoyment of that. And then I know Alec Berg, who is the showrunner, I guess, I'm not sure. He's showrunner or the co-creator of Barry with Bill. Mm-hmm. I know him from college. He was on the Lampoon, and he and his partners, Jeff Schaefer and Dave Mandel, wrote for Seinfeld. They wrote for Curb Your Enthusiasm, and then he did Silicon Valley. Then he did Barry. Alec did Barry. And he did a draft of Curious George. And those guys, three of them, did a draft of Curious George for me when I was going to direct it for Imagine and Universal for Ron Howard and Brian Grazer's company. And that was a live action combined with CGI movie. Anyway, that version didn't get made. But anyway, Alec, I met with, I don't know, a few years ago about something, and then I didn't see anything. And then I saw Barry, and I saw he's doing it with Bill. And I'm like, oh, Alec's brilliant. He's funny. He's hilarious. It's going to be a great show. Mm. Really good first season. Then comes the second season, and there's an episode that Bill Hader directs. I think it's in the second season, called Ronnie and Lily. Have you seen it? Mm-mm. I don't know if you've seen it.
Mm-mm.
And I'm like, what? First of all, I didn't know he directed it. And I watched this episode, and I'm like, this is a standout piece of directing. And turned out later it was either nominated for an Emmy for Best Directing and a DGA Award for Best Directing, or it won. I'm not sure. And then I see it's directed by Bill Hader. I'm like, wait a second. Where is he coming from? He was just acting on Saturday Night Live. Now he's directing, and he's doing things in the directing that I just haven't seen that are new. And I'm thinking, wait a second. Like, it's certainly not C-Spot run to see Dick and Jane directing. It's not like the standard vocabulary of directing. It's pulling from, well, a later episode he did called 710 North.
Mm-hmm.
It's like George Miller meets Jacques Tati. It's like an action scene where there's a freeway chase. There's no
Jacques
CGI.
Jacques Tati, what a deep.
Pardon? Yeah.
Jacques Tati.
Jacques Tati does these comedic French from Mon Oncle and Playtime. He did these movies where the camera it's like a tableau. It's standing back and it's watching. And your attention is directed by the sound. And there's almost no dialogue. And it's hilarious. It's sort of a combination of Jacques Tati and Peter Sellers, like Peter Sellers in The Party.
Mm-hmm.
or as Inspector Clouseau. And there's that meets George Miller, which you haven't seen. You haven't seen it. So there's an action sequence in a later episode in Barry where he's being chased on the freeway. And it's fantastic. And there's no CGI. It's just cars backed up on the freeway. He's on a little moped going between them. And he's holding a bag of beignets, which he got in an earlier part of the episode, but he didn't drop. But they're shooting at him. And he's still holding the beignets the whole time. And you just hear, like, right channel, left channel. Boom, 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 boom. Boom, boom, boom.
Yeah.
And then finally, there's another guy waiting up ahead in like a pickup truck, and he stands up through the roof, and he aims a machine gun, and he fires at Barry and misses him. And then he holds out his gun for one of the guys on a motorcycle who's chasing Barry to grab the gun, and he grabs it and drops it on the freeway. And the cars are really close together. They're like 3 feet apart. And it's real, so it feels real. It feels tense. It's sort of like the Chris Nolan style, but with comedy. And then all of a sudden, the motorcycle in a single shot just hits a car, and the guy goes flying. And it's all like no music. It's all deadpan. It's all tableau. So it's like the comedy of Jacques Tati or even Buster Keaton or whatever, but in a wide shot. Like, there's no close-ups. There's nothing. And you just hear the sound. You hear the guy go flying, and then it just back to Bill Hader riding with the beignets as he goes to like an auto dealership where there's some interview in front of the auto dealership, and then he rides up on the rooftop, and no, the bad guys ride up on the rooftop and they shoot machine guns inside the store, and it's all in a wide shot. There's no close-ups. There's no cuts. They shoot the machine guns.
Really?
And Bill Hader shoots them from down below and they fall off and they die, and then he leaves and he's still got the beignet, bag of beignets. And by the way, the beignets are not a random thing. There's a whole storyline.
Don't tell me. I want to watch.
Okay, yeah.
Here's the thing. Dude, you spoke. That's calm compared to what you were telling me the other night. I want the audience to know. You were effusing beautiful, superfluous about Bill Hader's directing.
Yeah.
And I told you that the guy is a unicorn. Now, I didn't know he directed either, but I'm not surprised because the guy, I mean, I don't know if you know anything about him, but he's just an amazing actor. But he's also can do any character. Funny or serious.
Yeah.
He's a really good impressionist.
Yeah, he's great.
Amazing impressionist, but I don't know if people realize how, like, he doesn't just hang his hat on that. He's also an incredible writer.
Right.
And
he is.
But he also started very humbly. He started on, like, being PAs on, like, movies.
Right. Oh, there's a famous story I saw.
Yeah, with Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yeah, that's right.
So
that's-
he's... But you said that this is a top tier, like he's ready to do his own like La La Land.
He needs to do that.
Yeah.
And I'm sure he will.
Yeah.
And I mean, there's no question that.
And I just love it because people look at comedians and he's not. He does many things. I wouldn't label him. I would label him multiple things, not just a comedian. But right. they try to put you in a box. And I love that he's just jumping out of it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't have any. Doubt that he'll be able to do that. He has, you know, he talked about reading Anna Karenina for like the characters in Barry. He talked about, look, Barry is like some kind of crazy show. And he talked about Breaking Bad being an influence and so forth. And
mm-hmm.
Vanessa Bayer is in an episode where she plays a TV executive. Did I send that to you?
I'm going to watch
a clip. Yeah. And she's like,
you got to, I'm going to watch.
Sarah Goldberg is the actress that Bill cast.
I saw that scene by the pool.
Yeah,
that was brilliant.
Yeah, it's brilliant mom.
Brilliant.
Yeah, she's great. She's Canadian. She plays Sally Reed, who's his girlfriend in the show. You know, the premise of the show is he's an assassin and he wants to be an actor, and so he joins an acting class in North Hollywood, and she's in the class, and nobody knows he's an assassin on the side, and he's trying to get out. Yeah, I think I read somebody talk Breaking Good.
Now I love. Yeah, dude. It's incredible.
Yeah.
You've turned me on to it. I want you to open up and talk.
Yeah.
But you get scared.
No.
But people don't realize how you're so educated. You know, you went to USC, you went to MIT, and you went to Harvard?
Yeah. Physics.
Now, we were talking the other night about AI. And I think it's coming along much faster than you do. And
no, then, I think it's coming fast.
And then you sent me an article the other day, kind of basically you confirmed my beliefs because there was a whole thing that happened with AI.
Which one are you talking about?
Some guy hacked somebody for a bunch of money.
Oh, okay. Yeah, right. Oh, it was, what's his name? He did it, Cory Doctorow, who wrote Robocalypse, the movie that Spielberg is going to direct. He is a writer on technology, and he's a well-known
author. Can you talk about what we were talking about with AI?
Yeah.
And how they train it.
Oh, okay, yeah. Well, I was just saying, you know, prior to ChatGPT coming out, OpenAI has been around for a number of years, and there have been some, you know, I had been looking at, before it came out, I'd been looking for years at its progress because we were interested in using some early versions of the early deep neural net algorithms for the sound work that we were doing at my tech company. And it's really cool because someone did a demo where you could put a voice on top of a voice. Like you could have two voices playing. Sorry about that. Two voices completely playing, and you could use deep neural nets to separate out the two voices completely and play back one, even though they're talking on top of each other, and reproduce, basically, it's essentially reconstructing, I guess, one or the other voice. And the idea, and then you can, and with no interruption from the other voice. So that's a pretty sophisticated thing to be able
so
to do.
So you and I are talking right now, start talking.
Like we're talking,
Larry, what are you doing? Hold on. What is your issue? You got,
exactly. So you could take it and completely separate them, right?
Wow.
Now that's different from what they did with the Beatles, where they separated the voice from the music because the audio characteristics of music are extremely different from voice. But when you separate voice from voice, that's a whole other level. And then when you then the idea is that with enough computational capacity, you could separate one voice from hundreds of voices. So you could be in a restaurant. For example, if you have hearing loss and you can't hear the person sitting across from you because of there are hundreds of people chattering, and you could just zero in on a single voice and get rid of all of the other voices so you could hear them well, right? So that's some of the but that requires enormous computational power, and that computational power has been improving radically year over year, right? So it's getting very close. That solution, I don't know how close that is, but anyway, the point I was making was that as I was tracking this stuff, I was seeing, they did, for example, there's a great little YouTube channel called 2 Minute Papers. And it's like a Hungarian PhD guy in computer graphics who tracks progress in AI and CGI. And he's very interesting because he always says somewhere in the podcast, "What a time to be alive." He says that in every podcast. So if anyone watches that and they hear that, they'll see that my impression is pretty close.
That's a Bill Hader character.
That is. It is. He should watch that and he should do that guy because that guy's really into it. What he does is he'll show the academic research paper, the written part, and then he'll show videos that are associated with it and show the progress. And he'll show the progress from 6 months ago. Mm-hmm. So the training data that's been fed, the amount of training that's been done has increased and how it concomitantly improved the result. So, for example, they showed one with boxing. So they had two CGI, like almost Rock'em Sock'em robot-looking characters. That's not the important part. The important part is they're trying to train them how to box on their own, how to learn how to box. So the two guys, one's red, one's blue. They're in the ring after 100. By the way, I said 100,000 the other night. It's 100 million iterations of training, okay? After 100 million iterations, they're standing opposite each other, the two CGI boxers, and they're like this. And they're shaking. They're shaking. And then they both fall backwards simultaneously, okay? Like after 200 million iterations, they get a little closer, but they're still shaking. They don't punch. After 300 million iterations of training, they're kind of trying to jab each other, but nothing is quite landing. And after 400 million, one of them takes a swing and the other one gets knocked out. And you're like, okay, unlike with humans who have 3 million years of evolution in our brains, and our brains use far less power than these AIs do, which use an entire data center of power, like we run on a few watts of power, our brains. We can figure out how to like avoid a punch and throw a punch. You can do that when you're like 3 years old, right?
Yeah.
So these things take way more training now. It's going to get better, but now. 400 million iterations, one throws a punch. Now, here's the crazy part. Then they continue to train it further, 500 million, 600 million, all the way to 800 million iterations of training. And they come back together, and they shake and freeze, and they both fall backwards again. What does that mean? That means that we have no idea what the optimum amount of training is necessary to train something to generate the right answer. That's why half the time when you go to ChatGPT, it gives you the wrong answer very confidently. And then you say, no, that's the wrong answer. And they say, oh, I'm sorry. You're right.
Don't say that.
Let me correct it.
ChatGPT will hear you saying that.
That's okay.
No, it's going to be mad at you.
Well, maybe in a few years. Right now it won't, because it's got all these guardrails on it. But anyway, my point is that we don't know what the optimum amount of training is to make something effective for any given task, whether it's a narrow task or a broad task. And that could lead to what... So I think what will happen is, for example, now when you train on faces and you do, I don't know, deepfakes or whatever, and you have 8 billion faces on the internet because there's 8 billion people on the planet, that's a lot of data to train on to be able to like make a job. And then each face has 100 photos or 1,000 photos of it. So now you've got it from every angle. I mean, that's how they did like Harrison Ford, let's say, in the latest Indiana Jones movie. They looked at all his photos of him and they trained and they replaced his old face with his younger 40-year-old face. So let's say the 8 billion people times 1,000 pictures per person. So that's 8 trillion pieces of data. That's a lot of training data, right? So look at now people are afraid that, oh, movies will just get made by AI, and they kind of will, but the thing is there isn't nearly as much training data, right? There's only, in the history of movies, it's only 100 years old. Maybe if there's 1,000 movies a year at most, that's 100,000 movies instead of 8 billion faces or 8 trillion pieces of training data. It's 100,000 movies. Now, of those 100,000 movies, how many are good and how many are great? So maybe 10,000 are good, and maybe like 100 or 200 are great. I mean, when you look at the list from the AFI, you know, it's The Godfather, Citizen Kane. It goes all the way down.
How many are like 250?
No, they do like 100. But let's say there's 250 great movies.
Yes.
That's 250 pieces of data
yes.
to train from, because you don't want to train on bad movies.
No.
Because then you're going to make bad movies.
Yes.
Right? So what happens is, what I think is going to happen is there's going to be training on films, and you'll be able to say, if you're not a director, you won't be able to know where to put the, right? You won't be able to know how to stage, how to compose, what lenses to use, whatever. So it's going to kind of infer all that from the movies it's seen and try to do that. And you'll get these weird, you know, results. And maybe they'll get a little better and a little better. But at a certain point, there won't be enough to train on anymore, because there were 8 trillion pieces of data for faces, but there were only 200 good movies.
Right? Yes.
And that's many orders of magnitude smaller. So what's it going to do? It's going to start to train on AI-generated movies, like a next generation.
Training on itself.
Training on itself, and then a third generation, so you're, and a fourth generation.
So it's like a training on a cassette tape of a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy.
So eventually it's going to be garbage. And it might not be garbage to the AI, but it's going to be garbage to humans. Humans won't be able to understand what the fuck is being presented to them. Now, it may not matter at that point, because maybe the AI wants to go do whatever it wants to do for, that's all Jim Cameron and the Terminator, Skynet, whatever stuff. But my point is that if you just simply look at the process that's coming, and apparently I talked to a writer who's a freelance writer for The New Yorker and a bunch of other publications, and he said there's a term for that. It's called AI rot, R-O-T. And I didn't know that. I didn't know that was a thing. I just sort of speculated.
AI rot.
Become AI rot. So it's just, you're just going to be creating garbage.
But you said the AI trained and it hit its peak at 400 million.
Right.
And then
it got worse.
So we overtrained it.
That's right.
We don't know where to pull back.
No, not only do we not know where to pull back, but we don't even know what the AI is doing the whole time it's doing it. You see, it's a black box to us. Now, so now I just read yesterday or this morning that Sam Altman wants
$3 trillion.
$3 trillion.
$3 trillion for his next project.
Right.
What is it?
He's looking for embedding AI into chips. So it directly into the chips so that the whole thing is the compute cycles, right? So that's why NVIDIA is so successful.
I gotta buy a bunch of
NVIDIA. Was just graphics processing.
We needed to buy NVIDIA stock.
Well, you should have bought it before.
Like, it's gonna keep going.
It will. So what is the whole thing there? All it is what's called matrix multiplication, which is, in order to do these calculations, you have to multiply matrices. Matrices are just like 2x2 arrays of, and then multi-dimensional arrays.
Dude, my audience is not this smart. Go simple.
My point is that NVIDIA chips, which used to do it for computer graphics in like the 90s, now were converted into being useful to be able to do these enormous computations to do the AI.
So NVIDIA, so tell me when I'm off the rails here. Just so I give people a little bit, because I love this stuff, and you could talk about it, and I want you to open up. I'm directing you. Just to go back. So computers are basically, what I know from computers, the dumbest little thing is it's one and zero, on, off.
Mm-hmm.
On, off, binary, non-binary. And that's pretty much what computing is. And then as Silicon Valley, as the transistors got smaller, more chips could be put on the chip, more little transistors could be put on the chip, which made things computational power go quicker. Mm-hmm. Am I right so far?
Uh-huh.
And so now we've actually run out of physical space on the chip. We can't fit any more silicon, which is sand that we make the transistors on to put them on. And now we're going, what we want to do is go into the quantum realm, which is that computer that is stored under 233 degrees. And NVIDIA is the Indian chip company.
I don't know where NVIDIA, I don't know.
And they are now, you're telling me that Sam Altman wants to put AI directly on the chip?
Yeah, I don't know the specifics.
How can you do that?
No, I mean, I don't know the specifics of that. I'd have to
read about that. Well, tell me, you're smart.
Yeah, right, but I'm just saying that what you want to be able to do is do more computations per unit time in order to be able to be faster, in order to make a more effective AI. And in order, you can do that in software on a layer over above the chip. And I'm speculating that he wants to be able to burn it directly into the chip in either what's called the firmware or the hardware directly. But I don't know the specifics.
So the AI,
to make it faster,
all of the learning would be already in the chip.
I guess so. But again, I don't know. I haven't read deeply about it. But I'm speculating that would be the case. And
so what would that mean?
They're not at quantum computers yet.
What would that mean?
It would mean that what's called the compute, which is the speed at which the calculations are done, is increased by various factors, sometimes in order of magnitude. Order of magnitude is 10 times. So 2 orders of magnitude is 100 times.
So wait, the simplest way to do that is, you're saying exponentially? So to me, it's linear is 2 plus 2 is 4.
Right.
And exponential is
squared or cubed or whatever. Yeah.
So it's like very quickly you get to.
Sorry, not squared. 2 to the x is called that. So 10 to the 1, 10 squared, 10 cubed, that's exponential. Right? So if 10 cubed is 1,000, 10 to the 4th is 10,000. So it goes up like that.
And that's what these will do.
I don't know. I don't know the specifics of it, but presumably it'll just make it much faster. You'll be able to do it on a much less equipment. I mean, that's been the story of computers since day one. I mean,
do you think he'll raise the money?
I don't know, but it seems like all the money is going into AI right now. Like, that's at least in the next few years, all the VC money.
You said they're going to make a few trillionaires.
That's what they say.
And then the rest are gonna fuck.
Well, what'll happen is it'll be like what happened in the last round, which was Zuckerberg, you know, Musk, you know, like five Peter Thiel, you know, like 10 guys and women. Will win, and everybody will be supporting Apple, Google, Microsoft, Meta. So that'll happen again with AI, but. You know, there used to be IBM and General Electric and all those companies, and they got IBM's market cap, which is still in the billions, is nowhere near what Apple and Microsoft is now, which is in the trillions. So maybe some new AI, maybe OpenAI will dwarf all these other companies. I don't know. But it's scary because there's so much power concentrated in the hands of very few people. And then it could get out of control. I mean, Geoffrey Hinton, who's the Toronto-based British computer scientist who was among others, was one of the pioneers of the most recent version of deep neural net AI calculations, the one that has exploded and that led to ChatGPT. He went on 60 Minutes. You saw this, right? Where he basically said, we basically unleashed a Frankenstein monster and we don't know what it's going to do. And I feel really bad. Like, he's a modest, humble scientist who is doing this research that I think in Toronto and in UC San Diego and elsewhere. And he did this research with group with these folks, and he became a researcher at Google, and he resigned like last year, I guess, because of what they saw was happening with ChatGPT, which was, they couldn't believe what they had created. So if the people who created it couldn't believe what they had created, that's something to worry about. That's why they all wrote that letter. But it's a little bit two-sided. You know, Sam Altman signed on the letter saying we need to control it, but he also wants to raise $3 trillion. So it's hard to know.
Why was he fired?
I don't know. I think
what's your speculation?
I think, from what I understand, the board there thought that he was
doing things
not staying true to
transparently
the ideal of trying to control it a bit, like he and but everyone there loved him, and so he was reinstated, and I think the board members were fired, or some of them were fired. But I don't know the inside story much. I just heard that.
Dude, you're holding back.
What do you mean?
It's insane.
Oh, it's
no one really understands. See, I think AI is, I think in 2 years, if you read anything about Ray Kurzweil, mm-hmm. okay, who has done many different things. He's truly a Renaissance guy.
Yeah.
I think he's 78 and he takes like 120 pills a day to get to what he calls the bridge. Do you know what the bridge is?
No.
So Ray Kurzweil would probably be someone who is what people would say is a transhumanist,
mm-hmm.
which basically we're already slowly doing that. If you've got a piece of metal in your knee or a pacemaker in your chest or a little wire mesh in your ankle, you're already starting to become not just human.
Mm-hmm.
So Kurzweil is saying by 2045 was when the bridge to what is human and what is non-human will be completely melded.
Uh-huh.
And he takes a lot of pills to keep his biological body healthy so he can meet that. And yeah. It's basically a way to be live forever.
Immortal.
Yes.
Right.
Now, a lot of people saying it's bumped up to 2060.
But what by 2060?
That 2045 is where we'd hit this bridge
right.
where biology meets technology and you won't be able to tell the difference.
Right. And 2060 is what?
Is now looking like it could be that. Like it's 15 years ahead of schedule. And I've heard this multiple times.
Sorry, I thought you said 2045 according to him.
And yes, but now people are bumping it up and they're saying they're hiding it because
so you mean 2030?
It's 2030, excuse me.
Oh, you said 2060.
So yeah, my apologies. So when I'm meaning when I'm 60.
Right.
When I'm 60, the world would be insane, but I think every year
yeah.
we're hitting maybe not exponential, but we're definitely cubing some stuff. Like
right.
we're jumping very quickly.
Right.
And we cannot stop.
Right.
Human beings, do you agree, are a curious beast.
Yeah, I think.
And we cannot stop.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't.
And it's out of the bottle. Sam Altman will not stop.
Right. It's out of the bottle.
And,
sure.
And it's scary. But there's nothing really we can do. You're smart, Larry.
Yeah. I mean, there's a few people who can do stuff. Elon Musk.
How? How are you going to stop it?
The problem is other countries.
Of course. You think China's going to stop?
No. And then, I remember, this is an interesting story about China. When I would say about 2005, I was talking to somebody who was doing a lot of work around, you know, China was a big market opportunity for folks in the entertainment business years ago. You know, I don't know if you remember Mike Ovitz.
Of course, legend.
Was at Disney, and he wanted to, he'd been cultivating relationships in China to open markets there and so forth. And the Chinese just have this like long-term plan that's like 50 years, 100 years.
You told me that the Chinese are playing the long con.
Very, I don't know if it's a con, but it's a long game. It's to the ascendancy of, in all areas, you know. And to some extent they're succeeding, and to some extent they're not, but I remember hearing about this in 2005 when they were trying to get into the computer animation game. You know, the Pixar DreamWorks animation game, and try to make those movies there. I talked to someone and he said, oh yeah, right now there are 500,000 people in China learning computer animation at various computer graphics, you know, programs at colleges and universities around China. 500,000 in 2005. That's 19 years ago. Mm-hmm. So they just could scale up their learning far beyond anywhere else in the world just because of their population.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's absurd. I mean, when I started in computer graphics in the early 90s, we'd be lucky. There might have been 5,000 people in the whole world who were doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And all of a sudden, 500,000 people in China in 2005 are training, learning how to do this stuff. It's just the sheer scale of it, you know, knocked me out. Like, I realized, oh my God, like, they can just take over everything if they want to, if they're clever about it, clever enough about it. I mean, I have a friend who teaches, who's a professor at USC in screenwriting, and he teaches, he goes over to China every year. He's been going over for years to teach storytelling and screenwriting in China.
Yeah, Hollywood tricks.
Storytelling.
Yeah.
And they're not doing it because it's an altruistic, I mean, USC isn't doing it because it's altruistic because they get paid, but China isn't doing it because they want, like, friendly, they're doing it to learn the skills to be able to dominate, and now their Chinese film market, people go see Chinese movies in China, they don't go see Hollywood movies anymore. I mean, if you look at the numbers from this past year, apparently the Chinese films dwarfed the box office in China compared to American films.
So do you think that China wants to just dominate the entertainment space more than Hollywood and put their own messaging in, or just dominate?
I mean, to the extent that it's a free market there and that people are making movies to make money, that's not a conspiracy. To the extent that the Chinese Communist Party wants to impose power and hegemony around the world wherever it can with Belt and Road Initiative and whatever else, and to the extent that being able to put out entertainment and or propaganda in the world is helpful, you know. So,
dude, yeah. here's a Chinese AI story that I don't think people know. They're so ahead of the game, way ahead of it, and they won't stop.
They won't stop.
No, it'll be like a movie where the Chinese dude like built something and he got out of control and it'll be like, I didn't know, and it's like, it'll be like a movie. Because, so here's just one example. If you were going to borrow money from a bank, how many data points do they check off the top of your head?
10, 15?
Yeah. Right. What's your income? What's your asset? What's your credit score?
Right.
What's your job? Your history? Blah, blah, blah. Where do you live? Right. This is just one of like 1,000 apps that they do. China has a peer-to-peer lending app.
Uh-huh.
And it has over, I don't even know, 5,000 points of data.
Oh, shit.
So not just like those basic ones, to the point of,
like where I could lend you money. And
you can lend me money, and they will, with using AI, decide whether it's a good investment or not. You get a score at the end.
Oh, shit.
And it, even to, they judge you on how you stroke your keys. Like, that's like, are you aggressive enough? Are you milky?
Uh-huh.
Are you meek? Like, all of this stuff. How is your health? Like, they do.
Where
what is your friend
this?
Circle?
Where did you read about this?
You could, it's YouTube videos. There's a whole thing about AI. You go just jump in AI China.
Uh-huh.
And literally, like, they look at all your social media.
Yeah.
Who is, things I can't even think about. They go through you like a fucking virus.
That's insane.
And then, and it comes up in probably, you know, a minute. They go through all that or probably quicker.
Right.
And they decide whether you're a good candidate.
So wait a second.
So you can.
So do you know the name of this peer-to-peer app?
No. But it's on YouTube and it's legitimate. And the guy who's the head of, who's basically like the Peter Thiel of China, who invests in all these things. This was one of his babies, but he has like hundreds of investments. And this was like one. I was like,
it's not the Alibaba guy.
No, I don't think it's Alibaba.
Jack Ma.
Which I can't find. No one can find him. Maybe he's back now.
That's insane.
Yeah. Well, that's a whole other ball of wax.
But that's obviously a privacy. That's like a whole other level of invasion of privacy.
Yeah.
Security. It's like,
well, I mean, if you look in my building right now, it's a lot of rich Chinese people. Because they're coming. LA is becoming very. Mr. Chow's, shout out in Beverly Hills, stays open really late now. In Beverly Hills, but it closed earlier. Why? Rich Chinese people. They want to eat late. I like to eat late. So you could see that people are coming from China, putting their money into LA.
Yeah.
Because you got to keep your money.
Right.
So what you're saying is not wrong.
Right.
And it's happening. I mean, my building, I'm like, back in the day, this building would be full of, you know, struggling actors.
Right.
They can't afford it.
Right.
Struggling comedians, you know. Now it's like rich people from other countries.
Right.
Coming in and buying up a lot of stuff.
But it seems like.
Which I'm fine with.
People who are wealthy in China who are either buy a property or rent or whatever in the U.S. and Canada. I know they do that a lot in Vancouver. And I think Vancouver was Hong Kong because before that happened in the 90s.
Vancouver.
Pardon?
They call it Vancouver.
Okay, do they?
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think that was to get away from, you know,
dictatorship.
The mainland China takeover of Hong Kong.
But, yes.
But maybe now it's also to, like, diversify your money so that if something happens in China, you have it in Western bank accounts. But that's interesting about the peer-to-peer.
That's just one of them.
That seems like a crazy, like, that's a totally tech idea. Like, as soon as you said it to me, I was like, wait a second, that's a completely tech idea. It's like a Silicon Valley idea, but I haven't heard of it here.
No, because we don't have the capability. Probably do. Sam Altman probably has it. Like, but it's just not out yet. But like,
yeah,
you got to watch a show called Devs. I don't watch a lot of stuff. Devs, you would love it.
Okay.
Nick Offerman.
Oh, uh-huh.
Great. He's like
software developers.
Yes, people know him. Well, he's like a tech titan. I don't want to tell you too much, but it's really, it's just a show that just washes over you, and I was totally into it.
Uh-huh.
And like, I like those. That's why I want to watch.
I mean, is it like Silicon Valley?
No.
Okay.
It is Silicon Valley, but it's a dark version.
Okay.
And it's really, it's Nick Offerman's totally serious in it. He's awesome, and it's where we're headed if we're not already there. And it's basically all about building quantum and what it can do. And it's basically why he's building it. It's something in his own life that he wants to fix. Okay. So he builds this. Think of it like, you know, Dr. Manhattan. Are you familiar with all of like the, I forget, not, you know, Dr. Manhattan is or Rorschach?
No.
I forget all that. But the original comics before all this stuff was Zack Snyder directed the comic book movie. What the fuck is it called? I'm so stupid.
Oh, the
Watchmen.
The Watchmen, right.
So these are characters within the Watchmen, which was the first time, I'm not a comic head, but where I actually read something in the comic book and I couldn't put it down because they were real people with extraordinary powers. So there's a character named Dr. Manhattan and he kind of makes Spider-Man, you believe it.
Right.
And he's basically like can build any, he can go here to the moon and he sits there and he contemplates and he's like, these people. He's like so smart and there's different characters.
Yeah.
Anyway, there's like hints of AI in that stuff and about building this like God. And that's what this right. quantum stuff is. It literally to me is a God.
Yeah. Well, what it's meant to do is increase the capacity in the computer, again, orders of magnitude more than classical computers, just because it's more than ones and zeros. There's multiple states of possibility. But I just read an article saying that at least currently there, first of all, I think writing code for it is harder, although now AI can write the code. But also saying that classical computers have other ways to be able to keep up. But, you know, that will change in time probably. And I don't know there's a lot of hype around quantum computing, and then there's a lot of what's the reality and how, you know, like they've been talking about nuclear fusion for 60 years and they haven't quite.
I know, but you're basing it on, I read an article and you just believe the article.
No, I read a range of articles.
Okay, good, because you have to read everything.
Absolutely.
And you have to make
an informed
decision.
Decision, or at least an informed opinion.
Which we're not allowed to do anymore, you know that.
You can't make an informed opinion?
No.
Why?
Because you're supposed to just believe what they give you.
Well, who's they? What do you mean?
You know what I'm talking about.
I don't know who you're talking about.
If I were to not believe, if the people just subscribe to CNN,
right,
and I go, well, I don't know if I totally believe all this. I'm going to watch some Fox News.
Right.
The people at CNN, if I look at Fox News, would say, oh, you're a right wing.
Yeah, that's true.
And it's just like, no, or if I want to watch them.
If you look at Fox News, they'll say, oh, and
you're a left wing.
You're left wing.
But so I have to look at that. I have to look at NPR. Yeah. I have to read The Atlantic. I have to listen to Ben Shapiro. I take information, I listen to Rogan, I go and get it from all different. But if zealots in those groups really believe their thing, if you go outside of it, the echo chamber, they'll call you, they'll judge you.
I mean, the thing is, there's that, which is a level of quote-unquote research. Yes. But it's a surface level, regardless, wherever it is, Fox News, Ben Shapiro, whoever it is, that's a level of abstraction or several levels of abstraction removed from the actual expertise. So you got to go read the papers. Forget about watching CNN. Read the original scientific research paper on whatever the subject matter is, global warming to whatever, okay? But you're not an expert in statistical analysis. So at some point, you have to be able to trust. The problem is not that there are all these different media outlets that are giving you biased opinions, or they're biased by omission, right? Which they are on all sides, okay? Because I look at all sides. I
know you're a very reasonable guy.
But it's also the fact that you can't, so it's really hard to be able to judge things once you drill down, because you're not an expert in the field. So how are you going to know whether the paper is correct or it's bullshit? How are you going to know whether the p-value in the statistical analysis is valid or not? You're not, because you're not a statistician and you don't know. Mm-hmm. So at a certain point, there has to be a level of, trust recreated. I mean, social media tore apart trust in the country, tore the country apart, caused the division of the country in 2016. I mean, social media act, you know, and it wasn't, have you seen The Social Dilemma?
Of course.
The Netflix movie? So it wasn't intentional. It was advertising dollars, right? It was a bunch of developers, 100 developers, optimizing the algorithm for your likes and dislikes. So you got ads and you got content fed into your feed that meant that you would be more hooked. And when you were more hooked, it was a self-fulfilling feedback loop. And then all of a sudden, the country's like riled up on the left and on the right based on your preconceived notions about and your values. So, and that was all just so that companies could make money selling ads.
See, I have.
By the way, so it was value neutral. It wasn't like somebody created a system to be able to do that. It's just that was the result of the system, and the system being the desire to make more and more money. By the way, which all I think goes back to this one class at the design school at Stanford, which is a class in UI, right? User interface.
Did you go to Stanford too?
No.
Okay.
But there's a famous class at the Stanford, I don't know if it's in the Stanford Design School or something, UI design, UI, user interface design, which shows how to hook the user the most when they're making adjustments on their phone. And that fed into everything. It's funny, you know, like this thing, just the fact that when the iPhone 1 first came out, you could swipe and things would move and they'd kind of recoil and it felt tactile. And that gave you a little serotonin hit or an endorphin
hit. Dopamine for sure.
And then, of course, layers upon layers after that with Facebook and like buttons and all that. It just led to this insane sort of addictive behavior on the phone that led to, and, it, you know, what was Facebook? It was a phone, it was a yellow pages. It was basically online. And targeted ads became the thing, and then targeted news feeds, and then you have the country splitting apart.
I never met Mark. But I met Sean Parker.
Oh, you did?
I have a woman. She's a legend. Her name is Robin.
Mm-hmm.
Bechtel.
Mm-hmm.
She's the most progressive person in Hollywood with tech.
Uh-huh.
She kept Warner Brothers very profitable when albums were going out the door because she knew how everything was going online.
Mm-hmm.
So she knew everyone. She hooked me into MySpace before anyone knew. She hooked me into YouTube. I was one of the early accounts with YouTube, all this stuff. And she said, this Facebook, you got to watch this. It's going to blow up in 2005.
Mm-hmm.
It was a year after when it was only Harvard EDU.
Right.
And so I was investing in stuff.
Did you invest in it?
And I said, I want to invest. I said, I want to become a member. And Sean Parker was like, you can't. And I go, why? And he goes, because it's private.
That's private.
Because I wasn't in college and I wanted to invest and they were already had so much. But I met him because she knows him. She knows everyone.
Yeah.
And I said, this is going to blow up. And
you were right, but you didn't invest.
Well, I couldn't. Right. They had institutional investors and they weren't taking monies.
Right.
And here's the issue. There was a point where Terry Semel offered them $1 billion.
All right, I remember.
And Mark said no. And that's when I met Sean Parker.
Okay.
And he was like, a lot of people wanted him to take that bill.
Didn't Terry Semel buy Yahoo or something?
Yeah, he did. And this dude had the vision to see, boom, what it is.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, that's just like the one in a billion brain. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So...
do you remember reading, I don't know if this is apocryphal or true, but online you can find a text message that Mark Zuckerberg sends to his friends saying, I can't believe these fucking people are giving me all their private information.
Ooh.
I don't know if this is like a Snopes, you know, like a false thing or if it's real, but it seems like it might have been real.
Dude, I believe it. Listen.
That's when he was in college.
Yeah, I mean, the guy was, it's incredible. I'll stay on Hollywood because you're holding back a little bit and I love you, but you're so effusive, but you're a little scared because you got this image. You're still believing in the Hollywood system and I'm done with it.
Believing in it?
Do you think Hollywood is dying?
It's definitely transforming in ways that are unpredictable.
How's your politician career? Come on, man. Be blunt.
No, I think that there's some chaos in the system. The chaos is...
it's always changed.
Yeah.
But now I feel like it's gone...
it's blowing apart.
Right. Thank you.
Right. To a certain extent, yeah. I mean, I think streaming was a huge...
The short-term
desire for profits in streaming meant that all of a sudden all these streamers rose up. And now all of a sudden there's going to be consolidation because they can't all be profitable and not everybody's going to pay for every. And it used to be you paid $110 a month for cable. And now if you want Apple, Netflix and everything else, it's $110.
Exactly.
So those are going to consolidate. And they haven't figured out on the business side, they haven't figured out a business model that's profitable, amazingly, because they're making 500 shows and they've got all these hundreds of millions of subscribers. But they haven't I don't know, somehow figured out how to, supposedly, they're saying, they haven't figured out how to make it profitable. And so, because the model is so new and it's so fluid.
So are you saying Netflix is not profitable?
I don't know about Netflix, but my understanding is Disney Plus is in trouble. That's Disney. I mean, they have deepest, you know, extremely deep pockets. You know, and some of the others are. I don't know what the status of Netflix is, but it's amazing to me because they generate hundreds of shows now, way more than ever existed in the past.
Yeah, you know what shows would come out?
They don't have enough subscribers, and now they need to put ads back in, and nothing. It's like a crazy. Now they have ads, but you have to pay for it, but pay less with ads, so you have to stop every. I watched Fargo, and it's like commercials again. It's like it might as well be like network TV from the 80s or something.
Which is a proven model. Dude,
which was a proven model.
Do you know what would come on in the late 70s when I was a kid, and I'd sit in front of the box? You'd have All in the Family.
Right.
The Jeffersons, and Good Times.
And Good Times. Norman Lear.
And all three of them were cultural hits.
That's right.
Now you can release a billion things, and you get, you know, and then you get one Barry. You know what I mean?
Right.
And you get, you, it's just, you get a euphoria. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I mean, there was the golden age. I mean, the Sopranos.
But everything would hit because they would focus on just making one thing good.
Yeah. I mean, it's weird because I also remember TV being, even though there was great things like the Norman Lear shows, tons of bad shows that were
But
awful.
They still made a mark.
It made a mark, but the things that made...
I don't know if Alf was bad. I never really watched it, but it made a mark.
Right, but the...
Silver Spoons made a mark.
But the tip of the spear, at least until very recently, was theatrical film. That was like... And everything trickled down.
Yes.
From the movie that was a hit that had made a cultural mark. I mean, Tarantino talks about that, right? He's like, what movie have you seen that was released directly for Netflix has made any impression whatsoever in the culture? Like Red Notice, whoever heard of... You know, and it's got all
these movie correct. Stars in it. He is correct. I would say what I think about is Squid Games. It's not a movie.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point. Right.
It's Squid Games, right. Which they found in Korea for nothing.
Right. That's pretty. Do you know the story of that? So, that director, the creator.
The Irishman.
Uh-huh.
The Irishman. That made a mark.
Yeah. No, and Breaking Bad, and, you know.
But that wasn't originally for Netflix.
Right.
What's the story of Squid Games?
Just that he went to USC Film School. He
Squid Game guy?
Yeah. So he had this image, I don't know if you remember, in the opening, in the pilot, of the Korean doll, giant plastic doll with the eyes that are moving for the game, red light, green light game, the last person gets shot, right? So that doll that's saying it in Korean, red light, green light, and her eyes are mechanically moving around. He had this image in his head about that. So the cultural reference was something he knew that probably came from Korea, not from the U.S., but he had an image in his head. And that's the thing I remember the most about that entire 8 or 10 episode series is that opening sequence. And so he started with the right sequence. It's close to the opening. I don't think it's the exact opening. It's close to the opening. But he started with that sequence. And that came from something that was so compelling in his mind that he put it out there in front of people. And it compelled them too. And it's a great example of like the art is just... There's no like bean counting on art. It's
None.
Like it's like a home run or a foul ball, right? This is function called the Dirac delta function in physics, where it's like everything's at zero and then all of a sudden it shoots up to infinity and comes back down. And like if you hit that one place where something resonates, like called the resonant frequency is another concept. It's similar where that's what happens when there's feedback with a microphone. It suddenly goes to infinity.
Okay.
That's what happened with that idea. But I love that idea that you could never plan on that. A guy had to think of something. he didn't actively think about it. It entered his mind. He was obsessed by it, and he stuck it in the beginning of his show. And then the result of that is this cultural phenomenon.
Dude, I tell people that all the time. My buddy wants to make this movie with me, and he's like, well, we have to raise the money. And I'm like, it's not. This is not a raising of the money. It's, you have to take a chance. Mm-hmm. This is not the business to try to make money.
Right.
You want to make something, it has to be very risky.
Right.
You know what I mean? If you're an independent producer, that's how you have to do it. Don't sit there and
try to do a calculation.
Yeah, because you can't. Like my friend, another director, Michael Lattis, who's a friend of mine, he said, you can't put a price on penguins. Remember March of the Penguins?
Yeah, right.
Came out in the summer and made $81 million.
Right.
Because how do you... You can't.
You can't.
So it's like if you make something good, like you said, it goes back to Barry, something very original and unique, and if you make it for a price, they will come.
Yeah.
And they have time. That's what all these streamers are doing. Streamers are discovering some older IP that they think is great that never got the push with marketing.
Right.
But, you know, so it's just, but for me, the business is so different now. Like, you probably don't think it is, but to me, I think it's completely different. And I talk about it like, what are movies even right now? What are movies?
Right.
What are movies? Julia Roberts just did a movie for Netflix.
Right.
Did you see it?
No.
Exactly. Probably didn't even know about it. George Clooney did one. Did you see it?
No.
Exactly. Right. Like, what are people seeing? Like,
yeah.
You know, it is Quentin. That's the last movies, you know, or.
Yeah. It's tough.
But what's the business? I think people are getting less because of all of this stuff, and it's fine. I like social media, and I don't like because social media exposed a lot of lies, mm-hmm. which I think is good.
Uh-huh.
But it made everybody think that they're Tarantino, and they're not.
I remember in the early 90s, maybe, when like... coffee houses started opening.
Yep.
And then that concept became branded, became Starbucks and became franchised, and that everybody, you couldn't get, all of a sudden you would sit down and buy and spend $5 on a coffee when it used to be 50 cents right before then, right? And people, I remember thinking, oh, people like doing this because they like the feeling of kind of being celebrities, being able to go out and sit down and have a foo-foo coffee at like they're in Paris or something at a cafe or whatever, and spending that kind of money, that's a kind of a crazy thing to spend money on, but they did it. And then to me, social media is like just an evolution of that mentality where you can feel like you're elevated somehow because you're at a, you know, foo-foo cafe having your expensive latte or whatever. You know what I mean? I mean, I guess the coffee was better, for sure, mm-hmm. than coffee in the 80s,
oh, it would be a cup of coffee with 70s. A cup of coffee with cream and sugar. You right. get a guy, and you have a calculator, right. Texas Instrument, and he'd be at the office, and he'd pick up his phone and go, hey, Joyce, and then let me get a cup of... Coffee but, was but like for detectives.
Right, exactly. But the coffee house was like the experience of going out and doing it and feeling a little bit above the mundane, I think. And I think that social media is like a whole other level of trying to get that feeling and trying to get likes and trying to get people to pay attention to you. And like you said, the narcissism of it and whatever. And some people have actually succeeded at doing it just through social media and just through YouTube and TikTok and whatever, which is kind of insane. But
I mean, it's not insane. It's not insane because there's somebody, I think it was my buddy, I think this is Brian Callen said this. He said, the propping up of mediocrity is a huge thing happening in our society.
Oh, that's interesting.
But I hate to say this. How can I say this in a way that people aren't going to kill me here? There's very few... I think greatness is rare.
Right. Well, by definition. Right?
What does that mean? The definition of it says that?
Well, greatness is rare by definition because if everything was great, then nothing would be great.
Well, exactly. But what are we in now? we're in the, everybody gets the, you know,
a trophy or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if, to me, there's only one Angelina Jolie.
Right.
She's a Pantheon star that you put with the mural with Humphrey Bogart and Buster Keaton. You know what I mean?
Right.
There's one of them in terms of millions, tens of millions of people that have acted and 100 million that tried and didn't do it.
Right.
Right? So you got one Angelina Jolie.
Right.
Well, if there was 10 million Angelina Jolies, she wouldn't be Angelina Jolie.
Right.
So all the other people that now have the power, they prop each other up because they're not Angelina Jolie. So that their value goes up. Her value doesn't go down, but the interest to her might go less because they're into each other going, well, we're not her, but we're doing our own thing, girl.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
That's what's happening.
Yeah. But.
So this, but then, and they're caught up doing their own thing, so they're not going to look over here to Hollywood because they're doing their own stuff.
Yeah, to some extent, yeah.
To some, see, you still, I'm telling you, you still are holding on.
No, I
see it.
Sorry.
I see how people are so into their own thing now. They're actually getting mad at Hollywood.
Oh, I'm sure.
They're getting, they think they're bragging. They think they're pushing these agendas down.
Right.
If you watch award shows, now the Grammys were up like 50%.
Oh, okay.
But the Emmys were down like 50%.
Down.
So it's, I don't know. I just think that it's a fast.
Well, I think for however many years now, there's been an attitude of like, hey, just entertain me. You don't have to give me your politics.
Yes.
Right?
And yes.
That's half the country saying, hey, shut the F up. Like,
yes.
And just make me laugh or make me enjoy the movie. I don't need to, you're not an expert. I don't need to hear your opinion on.
Yes.
Whatever. So that, there's some resentment from that, or there's a lot. And then that coincided with this models of technology distribution just being transformed and the ability for people to become known just by YouTube or by TikTok or whatever. And the, like you said, the authenticity of it, like the idea that, it's not like made up, you know, local news where they have like tons of makeup and tons of hair spray on and whatever. It's just like a guy sitting with an opinion that talks for 2 hours. I don't know where people, by the way, get 2 hours to listen to anything, let alone this.
Background noise.
Background noise?
Yeah, they're doing something, cleaning up, and they put a pod on. It's a big thing.
Is that the thing?
Mm-hmm. And actually, pod producers.
What do you mean they're cleaning up? I mean, don't they?
Look at the shelf I did. So I was at shelf on the other day. I was listening to a pod as I was organizing the shelf.
Okay.
And there's something that really strikes me, I rewind.
So like instead of reading or something?
Yes. Big time. Reading is.
It's interesting. There was radio for 100 or, you know, 75 years. It's not like.
But radio, you can't control what you listen to. This is all about control. Just like Spotify. You pick what you want.
Right.
That's the whole thing, is what do I want?
Right.
When do I want it?
Right.
Can I have it now?
Right.
From Netflix to Postmates to whatever.
Right. But, yeah. Yeah, it's a different world.
Larry, come on.
I mean, I don't know. Did you want me to like acknowledge that Hollywood is, that the movie business is going kaput or something?
I just don't know what movie houses are going to become.
Right.
I don't know what stardom is anymore.
Right.
To me, it's.
Well, it's not like Oppenheimer.
Yes, Oppenheimer
succeeded because of the stars. Right.
Well, the stars.
Even Barbie didn't succeed because of the stars, partly. But
Ryan Gosling and Margot Robbie are real stars.
They're stars. So it was classic. It was the combination of that plus the idea. Plus,
the idea, the plus amazing story, amazing directing,
Gerwig's tone.
Yeah, everything. It was incredible.
Funny.
Oppenheimer, and it was on an Oppenheimer. But like I'm saying,
like a meal and dessert.
Yes, 100%. But right. just as powerful to me. I mean, I know Oppenheimer's right. Very serious,
right?
And it was amazing,
right? But Barbie was very effective.
Dude. Barbie was amazing.
By the way, I love.
I can't tell people enough.
My
to watch
favorite
it.
Scene in Barbie is when Ryan Gosling comes to the quote unquote real world, yeah. And he sees, and there's that montage of like how men are on the money and men are on, and he's like, "Oh my God, I have something to look look up to and to look forward to. So,
you know what's funny? I want to finish this because I don't want to lose this thought. Is that people got really mad about like saying it was a feminist movie. Maybe I missed the mark because I'm like, I get annoyed at woke and all that shit.
Yeah.
But I didn't think it was feminist at all. I thought it was right on the money. When here's the crux of Barbie. Are you ready? Do you mind if I sing my song into your face for the next 2 hours? Do you remember that?
Oh, I don't remember.
He's playing guitar. He's wearing, and I was
Ryan Gosling.
I was crying.
Yeah,
crying at that part. Do you mind if I sing my song? My mediocre song into your face for the next 2 hours. Meaning that dudes will do that all the time to get chicks. They'll put on some stupid toque. That's what Canadians, for a hat. And they'll sing one of their dumb songs by a fire and think it's going to like be the panty dropper.
Right.
And so, and girls are supposed to be like, oh my God, you're the Sebastian Bach. Or, you know what I'm saying? And it's like, and that spoke to me in so many volumes of like how douchey dudes are.
Yeah.
Because I see them and I just thought that was funny. So probably people got mad at that where the dude's doing that, but like a real rock star doesn't do that.
I think they were because the word patriarchy was used so many
but
times.
But it's funny.
It's funny.
It was funny. The jokes were funny. Yeah. So if they're shitting on the patriarchy, if it's funny, it wins.
Right.
That's the problem.
I agree.
It's funny.
Funny wins.
And it was hilarious and it was perfectly cast. And like,
by the way, I wanted to ask you a question.
Go for it.
I'm thinking of doing a film directing online class.
You're doing a pitch right now.
I'm just asking, what do you think? I mean, so it would be like a course on how to introduce the main character, how to compose, how to stage, how to edit, you know, how to light for mood, how to direct actors, everything. Mm. It'd be just a series, but it'd be live. So I'd be able, it's not like a recorded thing. It'd be live on Zoom.
Mm-hmm.
And then people could ask questions and I would be able to, what do you think of that?
Okay. Well, like we talked about this. There's masterclass.
Masterclass, but that's like a recorded thing.
Okay. Well, first of all, I mean, if anyone could do it, you could do it.
Uh-huh.
Because you're not going to leave any stone unturned. You have a ton of schooling on it. You have a ton of expertise by doing it, from little movies to big Hollywood movies.
Right.
You absolutely have the love of cinema. Like, you know, you're known for like big broad movies, but you know Jacques Tati. Like,
right.
You introduced me to directors I don't even know.
Right.
So it's like you're a cinephile.
Right.
Like you could sit with anyone. And so you are one of them. You know what I'm saying? There's no difference between you and the great directors in town except a hit.
Right.
You just need a hit, right? So do I think it's good? Yes. Do I think people will learn a ton? Yes. But you have to have structure and you have to say it's an hour or an hour 15 or whatever. Do I think people will buy it? Sure. For sure. I think it's
a good idea. I was offered, I was to be hired to teach at a film school in LA based on a demo I did and they loved it. And then there was another college where I did it for a friend online. And they loved it, and so it went well. And I just thought, oh, this could be fun. Like, just to convey. Because I think, and who makes this point? I'm trying to remember, like, a bunch of people make this point. When you teach something, that's when you know how much you know it, and also where you learn the most.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because you're kind of recapitulating things that you know and then discovering new things as you do it. So I just think it would be a nice engine for keeping fresh.
For yourself as well.
For myself as well, yeah. Yeah.
So you're pitching it right now.
It's something I'm thinking of doing.
You're pitching it to this audience.
I don't know if I'm pitching it to this audience.
Feels
but
like
I'm just
you
saying,
are, Larry. That was a soft sell.
Oh, soft sell, maybe. I don't know.
I think it's a good idea.
Yeah.
You know, with the entertainment business, I'm having a midlife crisis.
Why?
Because I think I've done so many different things. And now I'm just at the point where I just want to be me. And I think just screaming out into the ether is where I'm at.
And that's okay.
I think me as a character, me as myself might be more interesting than any character I ever played. I might be lying. I might not be.
Right. Well, I think people initially gravitated towards you because of the characters you played.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether it was Randy on Scream or whoever.
Mm-hmm.
But you bring something of yourself to the character you play, and that's partly what resonates with them. So now when you expose yourself directly, for some of those people, that's interesting.
Yes, for some.
That resonates even more.
Mm-hmm.
And also it shows that this image that someone might have in their mind of you as a character in a movie, now they get to kind of listen to you as a person, just like them.
Some people really love it, and some people don't. They don't want it to see. They don't want to see behind the character.
Right. Well, that was the premise of all the movie stars of yesteryear, right? Just completely separate your public persona from your private persona, and your public persona becomes a piece of PR, right?
And it changed.
I mean, all those old-time movie stars, they didn't, like, go on radio programs and just talk about their problems. And talk about they didn't talk about the state of the movie business or the radio business or the incoming TV business, which was going to decimate the movie business. Nobody said anything.
No!
Right?
They just had an image.
They had manufactured relationships.
Rock Hudson!
Right.
Wow!
Yeah.
I think somebody told me Al Pacino said that.
Al Pacino said that?
That it's so different now.
Yeah.
Larry, I wish we had more time.
That was great.
I wish that you would open up more and get crazy like you do when you're not the cameras off. I think your online class is a great idea. Tell people where the cut's going to come out. The cut's coming out soon.
Shit, I don't know yet.
We're working hard on it. But yeah, believe in it.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know yet, but soon.
Okay.
And then I created a little email for the class.
Say the email.
Can I say the email?
Yes, of course you can.
howtodirectmovies@gmail.com.
Ooh! So you want people to email you. howtodirectmovies@gmail.com. Email Gary. I mean, Larry. Damn, see that? It's Gmail, my brain. and we're going to see what the interest is.
Yeah.
All right. I love you,
and
buddy.
If there is some, you know, I'll do it.
Okay. Thanks, buddy.